Well, the scoreboard said I lost today, but what the scoreboard doesn't say is what it is I have found.
Hello and welcome back to the Tennis Connected Studios for April 1st, 2018. I'm Nima Naderi alongside Parsa Sammy, and we're here this week to review the Miami Open from Key Biscayne and look forward to the clay court season. This week's podcast is brought to you by Top Notch Tennis Tours as well as Health IQ. Let's introduce our co-host for this week. Parsa, how are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. What else can I say besides USA?
Yeah, I mean, they dominated the Miami Open, which is very fitting, and we'll get into that, which being the last year that it's in Crandon Park in Key Biscayne, moving to the Hard Rock Stadium next year in the heart of Miami. So we'll see how that goes. But
which I'm a bit excited about, Nima. They gave like a preview on ESPN of what they're doing.
Yes.
I mean, it's going to be an insane place to watch tennis.
It looks pretty baller, yeah. I think it's going to be like very glitzy, you know what I mean? That's kind
of... Yeah, they got the Art Basel going on, yeah. And the dance club scene, yeah. And all the food, yeah. And then the tennis. It's going to be this whole experience. I love where tennis is going, at least the following Indian Wells' footsteps and trying to make it a fan experience,
for sure.
Which is amazing. I think that's the way to do it, and that's where tennis needs to go. So I think that's all positive.
Yeah, and I think as you know, just to carry on with what you were saying, I think it's a great extension of Indian Wells, and it really highlights Miami a little bit more. Miami, yeah. Is this lively city, and there's no disrespect to, you know, Key Biscayne. I love the venue there. I've been there on a few occasions, but it's kind of secluded. You know, you got to take the Rickenbacker to get out there on the causeway, and it's this little narrow path, and then you get to the tournament. It's a little bit more... like secluded country clubish, you know what I'm saying? But this way, right. You're just in the middle of Miami. It's all the, you know, everything's happening. It's all happening. So you're going to get, now, I think, I have no doubt that it's going to be busy because Florida is a tennis state. People like tennis there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
That's what they do. Like they play year round outside. So it's part of their culture. It's part of the fabric of Miami. So I think that you're definitely going to see it do very well. It just really comes down to how they logistically can pull it off, because it's a big thing.
Execution.
It's
just, exactly
the execution, right. Is about a $60 million, you know, renovation that they're doing. They're gonna have some permanent stuff, and you know they said that first and foremost, this is a football stadium, so that's their number one priority. But they understand that now there's that tennis component. So let's see how it is. I mean, you have this major enclosure that you have to make more intimate for the tennis, because it's not a football crowd, and it's, you know, they're going to have some outside courts. Let's see how those play, because they're going to be on concrete where there's usually a parking lot. So all of these things are going to have to be really manicured properly, and, you know, we'll see how it unfolds.
I think they're building courts, Nima, though. It's like they're going to build a facility.
Exactly, yeah. They're going to have a lot of permanent stuff too, which is great, because it will also get the people who are going there for football and other events to say, okay, well, this is tennis, so we'll look forward to that when, you know, middle of March rolls around. So again, it keeps that, you know, that synergy going, which is great. Okay, so Parsa, moving in now to, so just I'll review quickly what we're going to talk about today. We're going to get into the winners for the women's, then the men's. We'll talk a little bit about Federer and his early loss, which was not what any of us had suspected. Nadal coming back this week, great news. Davis Cup, as you said in our previous podcast, he's going to be just fine for the clay.
Yeah.
Looks like that's about to take place, so get ready for that. Then we'll break for a second and then get to Serena Collins. Great story from her. And then the Djokovic and Agassi saga, which is no more. So, Parsa, so straight up, let's get into it. Start off with the women's final, which was won by Sloane Stephens, reigning U.S. Open winner, over the reigning French Open champion, which is Lene Ostapenko. So what, you know, how did you feel about that match and how it transpired and went down?
I mean, how do I feel about it? It's like, you know, don't win for 5 months after winning the U.S. Open. Yeah, normal. You know, that's what you do after you become, you know, the champion of the world, winning probably arguably, you know, one of the most difficult 2 weeks, at least one of the four most difficult tournaments to win in a calendar year. She responds with that victory with no wins for 5 months on the WTA tour, gets into Acapulco, wins a match or two, and then who knows? All of a sudden, she just starts to beat everybody. Reminiscing the same sort of form, Nima, just a lot of balls in play, a lot of nice angles and great gets and awesome tactical adjustments. And it was fun to see her coach and her, the dynamic inside the match a little bit. Jovial, sometimes serious, you know, a whole just mix of everything. She played great tennis, you know, kind of what I expected coming from the US Open. I thought she had found it and this was it, and she was just going to do this week in and week out. But, you know, consistency and lifestyle and discipline is there's something to be said about a hangover after a Grand Slam. And, you know, she experienced that. But hopefully now she'll start to level out and continue to play at this level, because she's fun to watch. She's basically the anti of what a lot of the women on the tour are, you know, with all the spins and, you know, the delicate angles she can play. And that, it's actually fun to watch. I like you know, it's sort of, for the lack of a better analogy, it's sort of like watching Federer, who's a little bit more aggressive, and Nadal. You know, Nadal, who's defending and making great nets, and Federer's hitting all the great, amazing shots, and then they just put them together, and it becomes dynamite. And a lot of the matches, when Sloane's playing well, it's just entertaining. It's just fun to watch.
So we had a 92-minute affair between the two of these players, and it was interesting. I broke down the stats, which is on the WTA, brought to you by SAP, and basically, first set was close. They both broke serve on four occasions. So, I mean, serve was not at a premium. I mean, Sloane only won 25% of her second serve points, and Ostapenko won 47%. So realistically, you know, Sloane's winning that first set. Ostapenko's got to take that first set. By contrast, you're going to find this one interesting, Parsa. Second set statistics. Okay, Sloane wins 53% of her first serve points, 100% of her second serve points. So that's when you know that, you know, something's going wrong for Ostapenko, because her game is, you know, predicated on immense amount of power. And for her not to be able to step up there and just launch away and, you know, not tanking, but really mentally going away in that second set and losing it 6-1 is bad for her. I mean, that's, and she had, you know, she had a lot of chances there too. She only broke serve once in the second set, and Sloane. So basically, the only time she won a game was on a break, and then Sloane broke three times and obviously held.
Yeah, and the women's game is a little bit like that. You know, it's a little bit of like riding a wave, and it's not, it's a lot of momentum, and it reminds me of clay court tennis in that momentum is a huge factor. So the women's game, you know, arguably there's more drama and action, and this time the drama and action went in one way, and so it ended up in a blowout sort of after the first set. So, you know, but kudos to Sloane Stephens. You know, it's a second biggest title. I think she just enters the top 10 now, which is surprising. But you know, for someone who didn't win a match besides the U.S. Open, I guess it's not that surprising. But you know, now she's has the ability or the opportunity to continue to climb the rank as if she can stay here. But am I supposed to say that she's going to stay here? I have no idea, Nima. She
Yeah,
can go lose
exactly.
first round every tournament until the US Open and win it again. I mean, who knows what's going to happen?
And that's the beauty of it, I guess, in a way. Interesting, because on the women's side, really no turnaround time, because they're right into Charleston. You know what I mean? For the Volvo Open. And we got Caro Garcia as the top seed. Sloane comes in as the fourth seed, has a pretty good draw. And you have the likes of Keys and Kazakinka and Kvitova and, you know, some other players that are going to be present. It's going to, I mean, obviously green clay, but I think that's a pretty cool event too. I think it's very well attended, and, you know, the players really like it. So we'll see.
And talk about tennis being loved in a state. I mean, Charleston is a place where tennis is loved.
Yes.
People play it all over the place.
Yeah, exactly. So that's going to be, again, quick transition, where on the men's side, we don't have that. We have Davis Cup this week, so it's going to be a lull during the week, and then in the weekend it'll pick up. Then next week we got some smaller events in I think highlighted by the Houston one, which is a cool event. And then we're going to be back in a couple weeks after that, a couple weeks from today actually, to preview Monte Carlo, which is the third Masters 1000 event of the year. Not mandatory for the men, but you're going to see a lot of the top guys playing there. So now with what you just, you know, how we analyze this on the women's side, we have Sloane and Ostapenko. Obviously, Ostapenko is going to enter a time of year where she likes. She's the reigning French Open winner. So I think there's going to, that pressure is going to start to build for her. I think the one solace that she's been able to find now is she just made the finals of a very big tournament. So yep. Even if she loses early at the French, she's, you know, succumbs to the pressure or anything like that, she's got a little bit of a buffer. Because the Miami
sort
finals,
of, and then she's got quarters at Wimbledon. Don't
yeah,
forget.
Yeah, exactly. So I think she'll do okay. I could see her at least making quarters of French. I mean, I don't. Again, it depends on how much pressure she puts on herself. But the main thing for her, she's just got to keep hitting the ball. I think that as she continues to develop, she needs a little bit more versatility in her game. Because if she's off, she's going to be super off. But if she's on, I mean, she's hitting, you know, amazing shots all over the place. So that's. That's going to be, I think, the challenge for her going forward. But, you know, and then as we move to Sloane, I think Sloane, I haven't really figured her out. I mean, she comes across as this very grateful player where she doesn't have, you know, it's kind of like, oh, cool. I'm just, you know, I'm doing what I love to do and I'm making money. And, you know, she kind of said early in this year, everybody chill out. You know what I mean? Yeah, so I'm losing some matches, but I'll start winning again. And I mean, okay, well, so she kind of proved everybody right by this week, right? So I don't know. I mean, I really don't know what the clay is going to bring for her. It's definitely not a surface that's conducive to her game style with all the flat shots that she hits and she tries to rifle through. But then again, hitting flat on a clay court sometimes is not a bad thing because if you know you got a little bit more time to set up, and if it's a slower, you know, relatively slower conditions, then you're able to, you know, hit
it. She can spin the ball. She can defend.
She can.
So
she can. Yeah.
It's yeah.
So
if anyone can figure it out, please tweet us. I would love to hear it.
Yeah, what the formula is, right, for some momentum here. But we'll get into some of the other players. But I think that's, I mean, that's really about it, I think, for the women's, on the women's side. So as we shift.
And Danielle Collins, right, Nima?
Yeah, we're going to get to her in a bit. So in terms of the men's, so we had, I mean, what a story on the men's side. I mean, you know, finishing off with the last singles match ever in Crandon Park was John Isner taking out number 4 seed Alex Zverev, who looked really good and close to winning. He was a couple games away from winning his third Masters 1000, going 3-for-3, which would have been pretty incredible if you think about it, but it wasn't meant to be. Isner comes through at 32 years old and wins the biggest title of his career. And it was amazing because, I mean, this guy wasn't even on our radar. You know,
well,
I mean?
He won one match. He's
yeah,
another
like
one.
He was like
out of nowhere.
He was playing terrible this year. He was doing nothing. Yep. And then he comes in, and then that match against Delpo. Yes, Delpo was tired and he was weary. But, I mean, this guy just took out the hammer that match.
Yep.
Smashing serves, hitting 120-mile-an-hour forehands. I mean, it was just lights out and playing massive. And today he did pretty much the same thing, right? And if you look at it from a statistical perspective, he had 18 aces, won 82% of his first serve points, which is very high. And 60% of his second serve points.
Yeah, so, I mean, he was the one who had the chances. Even in the first set, I think he had 5 break point opportunities. You know, he was the one that was, he was the better player today.
Sure.
I thought he managed his game very, very well. He as many times as he had opportunistic winners, he also flubbed opportunities as well. And to Zverev's credit, he fought like a dog to try to make everything as even as possible. You know, it was, for Isner, when he's playing the right way, he's just a difficult out. And what he's doing right now is he's hitting the serve and hitting the next shot. And that's what he should be doing. And mixing in some serve and volley. And it's just uncomfortable to play him. You can't break his serve that easily. And all of a sudden he starts to poke 4 or 5 returns in one game. And you're just feeling a ton of pressure because he just has to break you once and you're most likely going to lose the set. So, which is exactly what happened today. Zverev was lucky enough to get him into the tiebreak in the first and not so lucky, in both, second and third set. I think, getting that break at the very end of the set, in the second set, although a very, it was at 4-all, he broke him, Nima, and then, Isner served at 5-4 and there was multiple back and forths, going on there, but Isner persevered and won that. And the same thing in the third, at four all again, he broke him. And, you know, what a way to end it, Nima. It ended with ace, ace, and ace. Game, set, match, championship. Just a terrific way. You could see his momentum, his adrenaline was pumping. And it was an awesome way and an exclamation to finish the whole thing off.
Yeah, and you know, we've talked about like the likes of Ivo Karlovic. I mean, listen, the guy's almost 40 years old. And he's still around. He's still kicking around. But he doesn't have the same, you know, ground game that an Isner has. Then subsequently, we'll get to Raonic maybe in a bit. But you know, he's a little bit of a better mover than both of these guys. And these guys have a little bit more off the ground. And then you see all of these. I think half of the top 10 now, not debuting, but featuring as of tomorrow's rankings, is over 6'6".
It's like, yeah, 6 out of 10, I think, or yeah, 5 out of 10.
Yeah, you got Isner, right? I think, yep. You got Anderson. You got Zverev. Yep. You got, who else is there? Milos? Not Milos. Not Milos is still out there, but I mean, I'll check it in a second. It slipped my mind. But, you know, one really good point that you made in our previous show, and we talked about Isner, and you were like, how does this guy hitting kick serves that are flying over everybody's head, how is he losing matches? And Chris Fowler made an excellent point yesterday on ESPN's thing, and he said that he thinks that if Isner just hit kick serves as his first serve, he would still hold serve. He's probably right. I mean, yeah, this guy...
It's Cilic, Nima, is the other guy we missed.
Yeah, Cilic is there. We got Zverev, Del Potro's the other guy. He's still at 6. Yeah, you got Anderson and Isner. Isner is up to 9 in the world now, as of tomorrow's rankings. I have it live right here, too. So basically, Nadal is back to number 1. We'll talk about Fed in a second. Fed 2, Cilic, Zverev, Dimitrov, who, again, as I predicted, did nothing in Miami. You got Del Potro, Team Anderson, Isner, and then Goffin is 10.
So what do you think? I have a question for you.
Sure.
You know, so now, is it the era of the big man, or is this still a function of the best smaller under 6'6 guys are injured in Murray, Djokovic? What's your take on it?
Well, I think just generally speaking, you're going to see athletes come in at a bigger height. I think that's just is evolution to a certain degree, if you want to call it that. I don't know yet. I mean, first of all, if you guys like Cilic, Delpo, Anderson, and Isner, I mean, these guys are 30 or close to 30. This is not the next generation like a Zverev. Rublev, I mean, the guy's not that tall. Khachanov, I think, is about 6'3". TFO is not that tall.
I think these guys, the reason they're doing better at an older age is they're learning how to perfectly apply their pressure and their game.
Of course,
yeah. And it takes nerve to do it. You know, what Isner did this tournament by belting the ball like he did was reminiscent of how he beat Federer and Davis Cup in Switzerland. It was the same type of tennis. He's just going for it. And, instead of playing that passive, grindy game that hurt his legs that he was doing this year, and then he can't serve and eventually gets broken, I think it's just just some sort of philosophy. And Anderson's doing the same thing. You know, it's just managing their match and using their strength to the utmost, max of what they can actually do. And they're performing at a very, very high level because of it. You know, they're using their strengths as much as they possibly can, and it's paying off. That's for sure.
Yeah, and I think it's also, you know, most of the guys, I don't look at one guy right now in the top 10 who's not a hard worker. You know what I'm saying? Every single one of these guys is ultra professional. And you saw the admiration that Zverev and Isner had for each other today in the post-match, you know, speech on court, where, you know, Zverev basically said, "Thanks, John, for practicing with me since I was 14 down at Saddlebrook. And, you know, you really taught me a lot about the game." And then Isner came up after and he said, "Listen, you know what, man, this guy's the future of the sport. I see how hard you've worked for the last 4 years. You totally deserve everything you have. And you're completely on the right track to being the best player in the world." And I mean, that's what it is. There's no substitute for hard work. And even at this level, these guys are really putting in those extra hours. Like, you look at a guy like Federer. I mean, the guy's almost 37 and he's still grinding away. Nadal's doing everything he can to get back, and he will be back. Cilic, super hard worker. We know how hard even Dimitrov works, team works, all of these guys. Del Potro, what a great story he's been. I mean, he had his win streak snapped I mean, the guy is just playing amazing tennis right now. And I think if he manages himself properly, if I was Delpo, I wouldn't come back until Madrid. I would do Madrid, Rome, French. He's going to do well on grass because he likes that surface. And then kind of do the hardcore thing. And that's kind of where I think he wants to peak again. But I would not play Monte Carlo. I would take basically all of April off. Just chill. You know, go back to Argentina. Have some nice steak. Relax. You know, put your feet up. You've done an amazing... I mean, he won Acapulco. He won Indian Wells. And then he made, what, semis and quarters of Miami. So just in a tremendous result for him. And, you know, that was amazing. But we got to get now to Parsa. So congrats to Isner as well as Zverev. They both kind of turned around their seasons here because they were both struggling. Yep. And that's where you show that there's that land of opportunity. And that's kind of happening because we're kind of in this gray area transition with Federer losing early, Nadal not present, Djokovic losing first round, Murray not present, Wawrinka not present. I mean, these are guys who have minimum, five of these guys that I mentioned have won a minimum of 3 Grand Slams till 20. None of these guys were a factor in this tournament. You're going to see a Zverev come through because he's obviously still playing really well, or a guy like Isner who just put it all together after a terrible beginning to the season.
I am craving a tournament where all these guys are just completely healthy, and I just want to see what would happen because there's like a legit, you know, there's this top 10,
yeah,
and then there's all your injured guys.
Yes.
You know, you kind of have your top 10 is actually a top 20 right now, so what you would have some terrific matches early in the tournament in a slam, and God knows what could happen of just high level stuff.
You know, Parsa, before we get into to Roger Federer and his early loss, so we got Nadal didn't play. He's back to number one in the world. We have Federer, who lost his first match to Kokkinakis, who's back down to 2 in the world. We have Djokovic, who's 13 in the world. He lost to Benoit Paire, which was just a terrible loss for him. We got Wawrinka, who's 21 in the world. And then you got, I got to keep scrolling, and then you got Andy Murray at 30 in the world right now. And I mean,
it's just... And he claims he's going to be back.
Yeah, I think he's playing some challengers, maybe even before, if he's feeling good. He's down at Mortoglu right now training. They dedicated a court to him a couple days ago. So he's looking, he definitely wants to do it. Like, it's just really a question of, I don't think with him, as maybe, you know, Djokovic has some other things that he's, you know, trying to get through. But with Murray, I think it's completely physical. I don't think it's a mental, you know, some mental stuff that he's got to work through. I think with Murray, it's just strictly physical. His body broke down after that amazing year that he put forward to get to number one, and he hasn't recovered. And I mean, it's almost 2 years now, right?
So yeah, there's a price for everything, right, Nima?
As well, as you always say, and that's very, very well said. Okay, so now Fed losing first round. How much, I mean, it was interesting because in our last podcast where he lost to Delpo and he really could have won that match, he had some match points in the Indian Wells final, he said that, listen, you guys expect me to win all these matches and I make it look so easy, but it's really not that easy. Now, that said, with Federer losing in Indian Wells, immediately jumping on a plane, so he's in the West Coast, goes all the way East Coast, I don't know what would you say that is, Parsa, about 5 hours? From Chicago.
To Chicago?
Yeah, it's about 5 hours, right? Even with his
not
jet.
Not really. It's
even
about,
with the Fed jet.
Like 3 or 4.
So
what was that?
Even with the Fed jet, right? He's got the private jet and everything.
Yeah, so it's probably like 3 hours. I mean, normal, most people would have to, you know, have a stop somewhere. You know, he goes from runway to runway and he's in his hotel room.
Yeah, so let's say, but it's still a different time zone as well. That's for sure,
different,
right?
Different time zone and different activity, you know, different mindset. He's not preparing. You're getting to Labor Cup, right?
Yes.
In Chicago?
Yes.
You know, promotional stuff between these two tournaments is definitely very tricky. He's not spending his time resting with his feet up and, you know, hydrating and getting massages 24 hours a day. You know, he's doing business.
Exactly. So he does that. Then he again jumps on a plane and he goes from Chicago to Miami at least a couple hours, right?
So yeah, another 3 or 4 hours.
Yeah. So then he's in another, you know, another place. I mean, much warmer, obviously, because Chicago is still pretty cold because it's close to us. And, you know, then he has to get on the grounds, hitting on center court. Everybody's going bananas. Then at night, he's got to go to Nike, do another shoe launch for his latest shoes. And then it's like, you know, there's so much, right? And he's a human being after all. I know he can handle it and he loves it, but he's still a human being. And then he's playing Kokkinakis, who's hungry. He's coming back. He you know, he's got this, he's only 20. You know, Kokkinakis is only 20 years old still, eh? We've been saying this guy for so long. I thought he was like 23. He's only 20. He's hitting rocket forehands, feeling good. And, you know, that's the type of stuff. And he just barely lost that match. But it's interesting because Federer has now lost two matches in a row, both 7-6 in the third set. That's got to bother him, in my opinion. Now, subsequently, right after that, so this is the main thing we're going to talk about, is it's interesting because I think I'm happy for him in a way. I would definitely, don't get me wrong, I would like to have seen him on the clay, but there's no question that if he played the clay, that would definitely jeopardize his chances in winning Wimbledon, which is really what he's targeting, right? I don't really think he's got a chance of winning on clay, even though some people might disagree with me on that one. I'm very confident with that opinion. So he doesn't do that. He copy and pastes, you know, 2000. He, you know, takes that. He puts copy, boom, paste, go to from 2017 to 18. And now we're not going to see him, I guess, until Stuttgart. Probably do Stuttgart, Halle, and then Wimbledon, right? If he does three grass. I don't know if he's going to do two or three grass.
Well, I think he's got a contract with Stuttgart, if I'm not mistaken.
So there you go. So then he's doing that too, because probably also because of Mercedes, which is one of his
main sponsors. Yeah, I think it's Stuttgart and Halle. That's what he's going to prepare for, do that little mini thing.
Yeah.
And then he does the mini thing in the hard court American season, and then he kind of slows down until the finals.
Exactly. So
not bad to be that good that you can just be like, you know what, I'm only going to play 9 tournaments this year. This is exactly how I'm going to do it.
Still minimum finished, like probably top 4, let's be honest. I don't think he's going down much less than that, right? So, with what you've seen, with his performances in Indian Wells, regardless of his loss in the finals, he was not as crisp, if we can say, as he was last year. With that, and his early loss in Miami, does this in any way hinder him? He's got a lot of time off now. We're not going to see him basically for 2 months. You know what I mean? He's coming back in June. And this is still, we just started April today, right? And he lost last week. So we're almost, you know, 2.5 months he's not going to be playing a match. Probably going to chill for a bit and then get back, get strong, feel good, hit a lot of balls. Do you feel that anything that's happened throughout March, which was an okay month, you can't say it was a terrible month because he still made the finals of Indian Wells, does that hinder him at all entering the grass court season?
No, I think you know, everything's going sort of by plan.
Yes.
You know, don't forget, anyway, he lost the last two matches, but he won his first 18 of the year. So it's, you know, perhaps he just ran out of some steam. You know, it's totally normal, as we alluded to with you know, all the appearances and everything that goes on. He is human, and he can lose matches, and they. You know, as much as it may bother him that it was 7-6 and third, the only matches he does lose are, you know, if you take 5 points and put him the other way or 4 points the other way, then all of a sudden he wins those matches. So it's all, you know, the bottom line is he knows how to play now. He knows how to compete with what he has. He utilizes his strengths to the best of his ability, and he's a pain in the butt to play against. You know, against most of the ATP World Tour is going to have a tough time playing against him. So you know, I think the bottom line is that he loves competing, and he's passionate for the sport, and he's passionate for the lifestyle. And, you know, I don't see that any win or loss is going to, at this point of his career, is going to affect him in a negative or a positive way at all. You know, and I don't think positively either. When he's winning everything, I don't think that means that, you know, he's going to continue to win everything. And when he loses a couple times, it's sort of, that's the game he plays. He's going for the corners, and it's not he's not sitting there and just saying, okay, I'm not that on today. Okay, I'm going to start rolling some balls in the court and start running around defending a little bit more like he did in his younger years. It's just gas all the time, and if it's not there, it's not there. Mm-hmm. If the shot doesn't go in the tiebreak, then it doesn't go in. That's just the bottom line.
I think with Fed, the way I look at it is, everything that we've considered in this discussion, the number one thing for me is that he has the luxury of being the best prepared player in the world for the grass court season. You know what I mean? He's got 2.5 months to really oil all the joints, get all the massages, do all the practicing, the physios, strength training, relax, mental stuff, whatever he needs to do, loose, stretching, best diet to get ready for that, you know, that period of year where he's really going to look to do something. And there's no question that he's targeting, you know, another major at Wimbledon, which would be his 21st. So we'll see how that goes. And, you know, with that said, now we're moving to the back again, number one player in the world, which is Rafa Nadal. Good news for him. He hasn't played basically since Australia after he withdrew against Cilic. He's going to be back this weekend coming up for Davis Cup in Valencia, I believe, in a bull ring, you know, which is, you know, that's his kind of his moniker. But what do you think about Nadal? I mean, do we really need to even say anything? I mean, this guy's won 10 French Opens. He just came out with a new racket for him, the Decima racket, Parsa.
Which looks sick, yeah, by the way. I Instagrammed you because the way the box comes and everything. Talk about, you know, reinventing something. You know, it's the same exact racket with different graphics and a different box. And I'm like, wow, what is this thing, you know? And I probably would be just like every other fan, you know, I'd pick up the racket expecting it to be different, but it's exactly the same mold, exactly the same material. What do I expect from Nadal? I mean, you said it off air. You said something to the effect that a podcast or two ago, I said, well, I'm sure he'll be healthy for the clay. Well, there you go. He's healthy for the clay. He's going to dominate the clay. And it's just very hard to play against him. On the clay court, it's just very difficult to beat him because of the way he hits the ball, the way he understands the geometry of the court, the patterns that he plays, and it really comes down to those RPMs. He can really just get that thing to jump off the court, and it just makes it impossible. If there were any holes in his game with his defending, on clay, it's a different type of movement, and he still can move extremely well on the clay and with a little bit of improvement on the offensive side. So,
what do you okay, Parsa? I'm going to put you on the spot quickly here.
Sure.
Who? What five players? Yep. And then obviously, Fed is not in the equation. That will be present during the next couple months. Do you see as Nadal's biggest rival on the dirt? Heading into Roland Garros as well as on the clay. I mean, obviously, we have a lot of tournaments that are going to come by, but who do you think are going to be his main challengers?
I mean, I think this is a terrific question, but I am going to come up with a good number for you. I think I can do it.
Okay.
I'm going to go with Zverev is going to be one. I'm going to go with Dominic Thiem.
Wow.
I'm going to go with Novak Djokovic.
Wow.
Diego Schwartzman. And... No, you're right. I don't know if I can figure out a fifth one. I'm not so sure about that fifth one, Nima. I could say Dimitrov because maybe he's going to have some good results, but he's not going to beat Nadal.
No, he's not.
You know, can Del Potro? Maybe Del Potro. You know, if he's swinging for the fences and playing aggressive against him, which he would in that matchup, you know, Del Potro is the kind of guy that's got the firepower to put it through the court and disrupt Nadal in trying to kick the ball up. It won't affect him as much because he's taller.
So here it is, Parsa, and I'm not sure if you were dialed in on this one, but from what I see, and I apologize for everybody out there if I don't have the right info here, but it looks like the team nominations for this weekend are with Nadal, Batista Agut, Corina Busta, who made the semis in Miami, Feliciano Lopez, David Ferrer, Sergio Bruguera as the captain. Now, you said who's Nadal's number one challenger is Zverev. Zverev's playing Davis Cup this weekend for Germany with Cole Schreiber, Struff, you know, and the like. So I think that, you know, right there, I don't think it's because they usually don't go 1-1 the first day, right? It will be,
right.
I think.
It's 1-2, and then.
So if it gets there, if Germany can prolong it, then, which I don't, it's tough. But although, I mean, listen, Cole Schreiber loves the dirt too, right? He can maybe beat Batista Agut or Ferrer or whoever else they put as a second guy. But I don't know. I think that this weekend is a little bit telling for me because I think Nadal needs to come out and win like 1-2-2. You know, because it can be five sets. Just roll whoever he plays. Or like
Zverev could be gassed, right?
I mean, Zverev could be gassed as well too, yeah. And he's still, even though... Listen, man, he made the finals and he beat like Kyrgios, who was, you know, a little bit of a shell of himself, and as we know, but it's still, he's still got to prove that he's ready to go. He's only 20 years old. He's not shouldn't be really that gassed if you think about it. And he's been in these situations before where he's played multiple weeks and done well, like Washington, Montreal. So he can do it. You know what I mean? The surface change might be a little bit of an issue. I don't know how the courts are going to be playing in Valencia. I have no idea. But
I'm sure they're watering that thing down.
Yeah. So I think it's going to be interesting. But I think the main thing for me is that Nadal needs to come out with a purpose and just fire through whoever he plays, if it's Cole Schreiber or Struff.
I don't know if it's going to be 1-2-1 or whatever you said, but I think Nadal's going to dominate the weekend.
Because we know how he is. He doesn't take anything for granted. He's a nervous guy. He takes everybody seriously, so he's going to really want to come in.
He's going to go thrash Cole Schreiber. I feel bad.
Yeah, especially
that guy's good, but that's not happening.
For sure. So I think we're all happy to have him back. It's good in a way because, you know, now Fed is, you know, on vacation. Nadal's going to come. They kind of know what they're doing, right? Nadal's like, listen, I'm going to be out for a bit, but you got Fed. Even though Fed lost early in Miami, he was still there for Indian Wells, and then he's going to come back. Wawrinka, we'll see what he does. I know he's in Monte Carlo right now. He was just, I think, celebrating his birthday over the weekend. He's hanging out there, working out with his girlfriend. And so I don't know. We'll see how it goes, but I think that it's going to be a nice clay court season. And we'll get into that, obviously, in the next couple of weeks with Monte Carlo coming up. So, Parse, as we get into the second half of our podcast, which is brought to you this week by Health IQ. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people, including tennis players, runners, cyclists, strength trainers, vegans, and more. From a tennis perspective, according to a 2007 study in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, tennis players who play twice a week have 17% lower body fat than the age-matched controls. According to a 1980 study in the Journal of Medicine and Science in Sports and Exercise, average VO2 max is 40% higher for male tennis players and 32% higher for females. As you can clearly see, there's a lot of health benefits to playing tennis. From a savings standpoint, 56% of Health IQ customers save between 4 and 33% on their life insurance. These savings are exclusive to Health IQ. To see if you qualify, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/TC, which stands for Tennis Connected, or mention the promo code TC when you talk to a Health IQ agent at the following 1-800-549-1664 number. Okay, Parsa, so as we start the second half of our show, we got to talk about the Queen, Serena Williams. You know, lost her first match to Osaka, right? And we talked about that can Osaka come in after winning Indian Wells, beat Serena, and then beat Svitolina? Well, she was able to easily beat Serena. I mean, she was really a shell of herself. And then she lost to Svitolina in the second round. But what did you think about that match overall? I mean, for me, listen, this is my analysis. I'll talk to you a little bit about it. From a headspace perspective, I don't think, I mean, we're talking about a player who's won with 23 Grand Slams, right? I don't think she's ever been happier. So I think she's in really good spirits, and I think she's, you know, she's feeling really good from a mental perspective. Physically, I just think she's a little short on matches. Obviously, she's only a human being. She's getting a little bit older. She's got to, you know, get that back in her system. I still thought she would do a little bit better over this month than she did. She won, I think, a couple matches in Indian Wells and then lost first round Miami, which she's won, what, 8 times? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think she's partially not conditioned enough, Nima, you know?
Yeah, so she's got to get in a little bit better shape, and I think definitely she's going to do that. It's not arguable. I think if you look at the statistics throughout her career, even though she's won, I think, 3 French Opens, clay is her worst surface. So that's, and we're talking relatively. I mean, if somebody only won 3 French Opens, that would be an amazing career. But we're talking about somebody who's won so many titles, right? So I think for her, the clay is going to be a challenge, but I think she'll do okay. And then, you know, getting ready for Roland Garros and then Wimbledon and the U.S. Open. So what did you know, anything else you can add on Serena and where do you think she really goes from here? Do you think she's going to be fully ready to go? She's not playing Charleston. I think we're probably going to see her in Madrid. I don't know if she's going to take, I know Stuttgart is another big one coming up in that indoor clay, but I think you're going to see her, you know, Madrid and Rome. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I it's going to take some time. I mean, you know, she birthed a human being, and the body goes through significant changes. Mm. And not only is she out of matches, but she's out of tennis physique, so to say.
Yes.
And so I think that only can happen by repetitions. And, you know, and then some, you know, drawing Osaka there is a tough draw in that there was a lot of players I think she could beat when she's a shell of herself and get the necessary matches. You know, she happened to run into someone who's on top of her world, and what a way to cap it off for Osaka to beat Serena Williams. And
yes.
It's you know, one of those things that it was circumstance that worked out that way. And like you said, alluded to, you know, for Serena, it's not the biggest deal in the world. She knows eventually she'll get her matches and she'll get her shape, and she knows who she is, and we know who she is, and she'll be just fine.
That's the Parsha Sammy guarantee.
Yeah, there you go. There's no, yeah. So, no, she'll be just fine. She'll figure it out. She'll reorganize her body weight, and everything will be fine and dandy. It's a long time to be off, over a year. You know,
yes.
It's not so easy to come back and be in that same kind of condition. And not to mention that she went through a lot of trauma giving birth. So
exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's something to be said for that. So it's not like she could, you know, gave birth and then could start training 2 weeks after that. You know, there was a whole long process. So it was a long time of not training properly. And so the heart has to be reconditioned. The lungs have to be reconditioned. The legs have to be there. And as soon as that happens, Serena will be back. Don't worry.
And with saying that, you know, how impressive has Azarenka been? Playing very well. She looks fit as a fiddle.
Yep.
And I think she's, no question for me, she's going to be, I wouldn't be surprised if she's top five by the end of the year. But
is she able to travel, though, or do we?
Yeah, she
yet.
Has some custody issues still with her son, right, that she's
right.
trying to get through. So she doesn't know what her schedule looks like. But I would think that she's going to play the French and Wimbledon, no problem. I don't know what her lead-up events are going to be like. But in terms of just her, she's very fit, looking good. And, I mean, she's... I'm very proud of her too. I mean, she's playing some good tennis and very good for the game. And I think she's kind of, you know, again, you get more of an appreciation, right, when you're away and you have other things that are, have happened in your life. And, you know, another player that we're going to be watching for closely and seeing how she does. But for me, very interesting and inspiring story throughout the month of March has been Danielle Collins, you know, and
yeah.
maybe because you're a little bit closer to it because, you know, of the U.S. stuff. And can you talk a little bit about her story? I mean, so what parts have we said? What, quarters, Indian Wells, semis of Miami?
Yeah.
So what is that? Over 500 grand she made in 1 month, and that completely eclipses her previous, you know, career prize money. And
you know,
so
the great story, the anti-academy kid.
Yes.
You know, it's just, you know, she grew up in public parks like most people, and there was no elitist going on. There was none of that. She was just hungry and passionate about the sport, given an opportunity. And I actually watched her play as a junior. She played against one of the players from our club.
Yes.
And, you know, she was impressive back then. She hit the cover off the ball. She didn't know a ton about tennis, but you didn't need to know then. You just needed to hit the ball. This was girls 18 and under. And she ended up getting a scholarship to Virginia and graduated all 4 years, and largely due to both her parents were not college educated, and they just were hard workers, and they instilled those values in her.
Mm-hmm.
She's been grateful and taking her opportunities, riding the wave as it's going. And, you know, just so interesting. If you remember a few years ago, she won the NCAA championship. She
okay.
actually took the first set. You and I were there, I think, Nima. She took the first set, not at the match, but we were on the grounds at the U.S. Open when she won the first set against Halep, who was one or two in the world at the time. And, you know, remembering that I watched her press conference afterwards, and she was so disappointed and dismayed. You knew you got someone special there. You know, got a college kid who's going to play one of the best players in the world, and she's upset that she lost the match, you know, where most people would be like, well, you know, Halep is amazing and blah, 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 and I'm so grateful for the chance, and I'm sure Danielle was grateful for the chance, but she thought she should have just flat out won the match, and so she was pissed off about it. And you know, when you rarely come across young kids like that, you know that they have the moxie in order to make it. And she's just proving it now that she's a year or so out of school.
Yes.
It's you know, she's showing that, you know what, this kid is tough. The insides are rough and just of champion quality, and no matter what situation you put her in, she's rising to the occasion, and now it's the best in the world, and she looks like she's going to rise to the best in the world as well.
Yeah,
I mean, not number one, I don't know about that, but she's certainly going to keep striving, and as long as she's surrounded by what she is, she's going to try to be the best of what her environment is, and right now it's the WTA Tour.
Yeah, and I hope, you know, I mean, obviously finances are a big part of the sport. I mean, this year she's already knocked it out of the park. I mean, making $500,000 U.S. is already going to take care of her for this year, even next year, realistically. But I really hope she can, you know, get a good sponsor, a good clothing sponsor now. You know what I mean? I think she's also a marketable player. So I think that, you know, that can definitely happen for her. She's a great story, especially leading it to the U.S. Open. So I definitely.
And she's also 24, Nima. I forgot to mention that.
Yeah.
I mean, she's more mature than the 19-year-old who comes up, or the 20-year-old, you know, CeCe Bellis, let's say.
Yes.
She's 24. You know, 24, you're very different than when you're 18.
Of course. So, Parsa, as we end our show and finish off March Madness, we got to talk about, you know, the Novak Djokovic and Andre Agassi saga, which is, we just heard that, I believe yesterday, right? That Agassi is no longer working with Djokovic. And it's a little bit, you know, for me, it's a perplexing ending to this partnership. You know what I'm, because I thought it was tailor-made. They were tailor-made for each other in many respects. Game styles, just backgrounds, philosophies, professionalism, you name it, right? And Djokovic was so happy and honored that this guy was in his corner. Agassi was so happy and honored to be his coach.
Yep.
And so what? So, like, he loses first. Like, is it because of the losses? Is it because we never, you know, that's the thing, right? Sports is such a, you know, we've talked about this on so many different occasions. I mean, we've both coached tennis for so many years. And when our players do well, we look like geniuses. And when they don't, people are like, what happened? Oh, first thing you got to blame is the coach, right? And in this situation, it's a bit different because this particular coach is an 8-time Grand Slam winner, one of the greatest and most decorated players ever for many different reasons, and, you know, most charismatic in Agassi. And Agassi, what was his quote? He said that more often than not, we agreed to disagree.
Oof,
that's a very politically, because, you know, Agassi is great with words. I mean, I could listen to the guy talk all day on if he was commentating or whatever he was doing. He's a very engaging character.
And very eloquent,
extremely eloquent. And for him to say something like that, I mean, that's just, you know,
him throwing a knife.
Yeah,
he's just saying,
but he said he wishes him all the best and all of that. So Djokovic still hasn't said anything, if I'm not mistaken, right? I know he put up a picture. I know he put up a picture today with his family walking in a park, you know, some Easter stuff, which was nice, but he hasn't really addressed this issue. So I, again, if I missed that, I apologize, but that's pretty much what I'm familiar with at the moment. But for me, I mean, okay, so this is the thing, right? We talk about, you know, Serena having to get back into shape and whatnot. Djokovic has publicly come out and said after his elbow surgery, his minor elbow surgery, that feeling good, the hand stuff. So, and he had basically from Wimbledon till the Australian Open off, okay? So he played one slam, then he played another slam, nothing in between. Physically, I mean, yeah, matches, this, that. And this is a guy who's won, what, Miami 6 times? I mean, I don't know how many times he won Indian Wells, but it's got to be pretty close to that. Won the Australian Open 6 times. I mean, this guy's a legend, maybe arguably, not even arguably, I think he's probably the greatest hardcore player ever. Comes into Miami and he loses to Benoit Paire, who then subsequently lost his next match. He lost to Taro Daniel in Indian Wells, who subsequently lost his next match. So it's not like he lost to a guy who made the semis or quarters. I mean, you know, Taro Daniel and Benoit Paire are not, I mean, we even know that the talent of Paire, but these are not guys who are knocking them dead on tour.
They're Novak Djokovic talent. That's what you're trying
and,
to get to.
And they took care of him pretty easily, let's be honest.
Yeah.
And so what's going on here? Is it a physical? I know the mental stuff you talked about. I mean, we don't want to get too much into the mental stuff because we don't know exactly what the problem is. But from the standpoint of, is it just that he doesn't have that mental edge? Like, what? Because he really didn't look like he wanted to be out there. You know what I mean? That was, but he's saying he's so happy to be back. And that's, for me, I mean, it's just, who knows what's going on.
There's a disconnect. I mean, that's what you can safely assume is somewhere something isn't, you know, the red wire and the red wire aren't together.
Yeah, exactly.
There's just something that's off. And we don't know. We can only speculate. Yes. And, you know, that's the trick. If you're seeing, you know, him and Becker parting ways, and then you're seeing him and Agassi parting ways, and, you know, you don't know what's going on. But you know something's not right. That's the thing that you can say.
Yes.
And, you know, we'll see. His ball doesn't have as much sting as it used to. He's not as free swinging as he used to be. And he's not playing the all around game that he used to play. Mm-hmm. And so I think that combination of things, and he's just not rock solid.
No,
you know, he misses before his opponents do now. So that's a big problem. So I think all of that combines, you know, if you take 2% of each piece of that pie right there, and all of a sudden you're 10% worse than you were.
Yes.
You know, that's right. You know, he's 20 in the world. That's where he is right now. He's not playing better than the 25th or, you know, 30th guy in the world. And that's what we're seeing. So, you know, it's a tricky time. You know, in this way, tennis is tough to read what's actually happening, you know, unless you physically see a change. Like, we off air, we spoke about Milos, who looks just jacked. Like, that dude has been in the gym. You know, like, you can see that, you know, or when Agassi, let's say, came back after his hiatus, and, you know, he was ripped. You know, you can see the change.
Yes.
You know, here, you know, you don't, or even with Federer's resurgence here, you can see his game style change. Like, there's something physical that you can actually see. With Djokovic, it's like, you know, he's sort of remained the same.
Yeah.
And he's just not as good. I don't know what to tell you.
So, for me, if we're looking at it from a technical perspective, let's completely be honest here. Imagine Roger Federer came back tomorrow. I mean, this guy's got one of the best serves ever, right? And he had an abbreviated serve motion. You'd be like, what the heck is going on here, right? Mid-career. And this is after he's won 20 Grand Slams. So Djokovic dominated up until the time where he's been dealing with all of these issues physically and mentally. He's hitting an abbreviated motion. So a serve is not as good. That's 100% certain for me. Forehand for me is not that much worse than it used to be. I think it's pretty much it. But his backhand, and we talked to Milos. Remember, we had him on our podcast way back when, and he said that, for me, Djokovic has the best backhand in the world. It's not the best backhand in the world anymore. And his return, I mean, and that's, to me, has been the biggest head scratcher. Because I don't think that's so much, because we've both played and we've had injuries and whatever. I've had some elbow problems myself, and two-handed backhand is no problem with an elbow.
Yeah, like, well, because, well, I'll give my secret out there. Yeah. And my students who always complain, they're rolling their eyes right now, but it's true. They say, my backhand's not working, my backhand. It is very footwork sensitive is the exact word that I use.
Yeah.
And if your feet aren't behind the ball and you're not exactly in the right position, the two-hander does not have the flexibility that a one-hander does, or a one-handed forehand does.
Yeah.
And so if you're not there, or you're getting pushed around a little bit, let's say the serve is not as good and you're playing a little bit too much defense, or the shots don't have as much sting, or you're tactically not playing with the same level of aggression, and you're able to get pushed out of that comfort zone on the backhand side, you're in trouble.
For sure.
It's not going to be the same.
No, and I think that's exactly what you mean. I think, you know, he's not getting behind the ball as much. His left hand is not where it needs to be, and he's just not firing. I mean, he's got to nail that shot. He's got to just come out and boom, 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 like ping pong, like when he was dominating, right? And I don't think he's able to do that anymore, and we'll see what his schedule looks like. I mean, he pretty much lives in Monte Carlo. I would be shocked if he's not there for that. It looks like Stepanek is going to be there. Does he hire another super coach? Who's really left, right? I mean, I don't know. I mean, again, I'm being honest when I say that. Like, who is he going to get? Sampras?
Becker.
Yeah, I don't think Becker is going to be there, because I think Lendl might actually be in the works of working with Zverev, which would be interesting for me to see how that works. Murray, I think, is going to stick with Delgado. I mean, I don't know. Maybe Magnus Norman. That could be a guy who could really do something for him, maybe, because he's worked with some really elite guys. But I'm not sure how much Magnus is into that right now. I think he's really focused on his academy back in Sweden. So we'll see. I mean, I don't know what the answers are, but again, we really need another guy there. Because for me, the main challenger for Nadal and Federer cannot be Mara and Cilic. That's my, and I love Cilic. And you know that I talked to you, how many times did I say that this is going to be a gravy next part of his career. He's going to do well, and he's doing really well. Even though he's still right up there in the rankings, and you know, he's made Wimbledon finals, Australian Open finals. I mean, the guy's there. But he's not that at that point or level where he can consistently challenge the best players in the world. And that's my honest opinion. And I think you need a guy like Djokovic. Then Murray, let's be honest. I mean, this guy's got a long way to go still. You know, and then Wawrinka, for me, a knee injury is a tough one. And that movement-wise, and he's not really the best mover to begin with. So I think that for him, it's going to be an issue. So we really need Djokovic back in the mix, and the sooner the better, in my opinion. So, I mean, but anyways, Parsa, I think that's what it is, and we'll get into that. And looking forward to the Monte Carlo draw, which will take place in a couple weeks' time, and that's when we will rejoin everybody and kick off our clay court season shows and episodes. And until then, again, Parsa, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Looking forward to the dirt.
Of course. And thank you, everybody out there, for listening. Make sure to hit up Parsa on Instagram, Twitter. He's got a lot of great content to share with you guys. Myself at Tennis Connected on all the social mediums, as well as download this podcast on iTunes. And as well, check out Top Notch Tennis Tours if you're looking to get down to any of the Clay Court Masters 1000s in Monte Carlo, Madrid, and Roma, as well as the ensuing French Open and Wimbledon with Grand Slam Tennis Tours. And finally, for Health IQ, for all you health conscious people out there, make sure to hit them up and get some great savings. Parsa, again, thank you for joining us. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you guys back.